This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenso, case 253. Shakyamuni's flower, the main case. One day the world-honored one held up a flower in front of the assembly of myriads of beings and twirled it. Mahakayashapa alone smiled. The world-honored one said, "I entrust the treasury of the true Dharma eye of all Buddhas to Mahakayashapa." The commentary. The treasury of the true Dharma eye has never been given to others and has never been received by another. Because of this, the world-honored one held up the flower and revealed the truth. Mahakayashapa did not conceal it and smiled. The lifeblood of Shakyamuni intermingled with that of Mahakayashapa and flowed into past, present, and future. Do you see? But say, since no one has ever transmitted nor received the treasury of the true Dharma eye, why was Mahakayashapa singled out from among the thousands gathered? What is the meaning of holding up the flower and Mahakayashapa's smile? What if everyone had smiled? Or if no one had smiled, what would have happened to the Dharma then? If you think the truth of the koan lies in holding up a flower, twirling or smiling, then you've missed the treasury of this true Dharma eye. The meaning on Mount Gudukutra is definitely present right here. Root and branches are the fleeting moments of the one reality. We should not miss seeing it. The verse. Appearing without form, responding in accord with the imperative, the fragrance of the flower held up fills the universe, existing right here, now. So it's nice to be back. I was away with Hojin Sensei and a group of other students for 3 weeks in India. Just came back on Monday. And so half of the group was from New Zealand, our New Zealand Sangha, and was led by one of our students who has quite a rich background that began with Edward Hillary. He didn't climb Mount Everest with Hillary, but he climbed other mountains with Hillary in Nepal, and that led him to spend much time in India and Nepal as an eye doctor doing cataract surgery for people who, in the high altitudes of the Himalayas, were losing their eyesight, and then going on to lead with his wife, Diane, lead pilgrimages every year for people. And they've been doing that for many years, and he and I have been talking for many years about doing such a trip for our Sangha, and finally we got around to it, thankfully. And so I thought this would be a good koan to take up, having returned, as this... This koan is the Zen tradition's presentation of the first transmission of the Dharma from the Buddha to the disciple, Mahakayashapa. And it is said to have happened on Mount Gudukutra. And while there's no historical basis for this particular dialogue, it's true that the Buddha spoke and gave many teachings on Mount Gudukutra, and that Mahakayashapa was there, and that the Buddha did hold up a flower, and Mahakayashapa did smile. The Buddha said in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, the last sutra of the Buddha, the last chronicling, really the last days of the Buddha before he died and entered into Parinirvana, that there, as his Sangha was worrying about, particularly Ananda, was worrying about having the Buddha for all of those years to receive the teachings from and to gaze upon and to see and be provided an example by, that now he was dying. And so Ananda wanted to know, in a sense, where do we turn our attention? In other words, what do we turn towards to show our respect, to offer our reverence, to see the body of the Buddha? And the Buddha said this, Ananda, there are four places that merit being seen by a clansman or a practitioner with conviction, that merit their feelings of urgency and dismay. Which are these four? Here, the Tathagata was born. This is a place that merits being seen by a person with conviction, that merits their feelings of urgency and dismay. Here, the Tathagata, the Buddha, was awakened to the unexcelled right self-awakening. Here, the Buddha set rolling the unexcelled wheel of Dharma, began teaching. And here, the Buddha, totally unbound in the property of unbinding, with no fuel remaining. In other words, here he entered into nirvana, he died. These are places that merit being seen. These are places of practice. These are places where we can turn our attention to the body of the Buddha with conviction that merits our feelings of urgency and dismay. And this means that turning towards the teachings bring forth, in a sense, resonate, are able to receive our dismay at this life, our dissatisfaction, our disappointment, our sense of confusion with samsara, with the endless cycles of suffering. And they're also able, in receiving that suffering, able to bring forth and hold our urgency, our sense of imperative. Madhavarishi used to speak of the spiritual imperative, the imperative to address our lives. And so it's quite beautiful and wonderful that the Buddha speaks of each of these places as places where a person of conviction, that is someone who is moved to examine their life. Of course, in this regard, through the Buddha Dharma, can bring their attention and be met, have those feelings of dis-ease be met and held and bring forth this great urgency. And so those four places are and have been since the time of the Buddha's death, the places of pilgrimage, the places where practitioners, Buddhist practitioners all around the world, have gone to do exactly that, to make offerings, to circumambulate, to practice meditation, to do, bring forth invocations. And so that's what we did. We went to these four places where the Buddha was born. We chant the Buddha was born in Kapilavastu, which is not exactly true. Somebody suggested we change that, and I said, no, it's too confusing at this point. And so it's known that he was born in Lubini, which was, 30 kilometers or so away, but he was raised in Kapilavastu. And then where the Buddha was enlightened, where he offered his first teachings, where he spent many of the rainy seasons, because he traveled around. And when we were there, I realized, or I thought I might have, understood better that one of the reasons they traveled so much and kept wandering was because wherever they went, you imagine wherever the Buddha goes, a lot of people are going to come, right? His own students, his own monks and nuns are going to travel with him. And they were reliant upon the communities for support, right? They were begging for their food. And so if they stayed too long in any one place, they might exhaust their welcome. Right, they might exhaust the resources of that community, so they had to keep moving. And then they would, he would circle around and come back again to the places that he liked, or that were, where there was a lot of support. And he wouldn't return to some of those places that, were not like that. And so we went to a place where he spent most of the rainy seasons, the monsoon seasons, which is, remember, the basis of our ango, the training period that we're in right now. And so when those rainy seasons occurred each year, they would stop traveling. And I asked Tosan at one point, because I've read that they would not travel because, and the Buddha would not allow them to travel because there were a lot of creatures sort of on the road and stuff because of the rains, and that they might step on them and kill them. And Tosan said, no, he didn't really think that was what it was. He said, you can't travel. It's hard to travel. Even today, it's hard to travel. Roads become impassable. Rivers, you know, certainly at that time that they had to cross with boats became impassable. And so it just was really not safe or practical to travel. So it's kind of interesting how that sort of just environmental relationship, you know, with the seasons set up this way, this kind of pulsation of practice where they would wander, you know, for all of the other months and then come together and gather in intensive training for those periods of the rainy seasons, which we call ango. And so we did go to Mount Kutukutra, which was, for me, one of the many important moments, but a real one of the most important moments. And we took a very sort of precarious-looking cable car up to the top of this mountain, very, very steep incline, and then walked down a long way, actually, a long series of steps, and then up again to get to Vulture Peak, Mount Kutukutra. And at the sort of the base of which there was this really incredible cave where it's said that Shariputra and Magho Moggallana, who were two of the Buddha's most closest disciples and who were very close to each other, would practice often in this cave while the Buddha was just a little further up on the peak. And as we were walking, going up and then walking down and then going back up again, I asked Tosan, I said, why would the Buddha have come here? This is such a far away place. You know, it's hard to get to. And then we got to the top and I said, oh. This is why. Because it was quite extraordinary. And there's a rock outcropping that does, in fact, look very much like a vulture. The head and beak of a and body of a vulture, and so, and they it's a very small sort of landing where they have just a very small sort of platform and a small altar, and it was one of the rare opportunities where we went to one of these major sites and nobody was there, which didn't happen at any of the other sites, not at the major sites. But there was a caretaker, and there usually was, and there was an old man who was a caretaker who was quite lovely and took care of us. And so we sat there on Vulture Peak, facing very likely the place where the Buddha would sit and offer his teaching. And then having been blessed by that space and quiet, then a very large group arrived, following us to do the same. And so here in this koan, the Buddha is sitting on Vulture Peak in front of the assembly, the students who have gathered, and he holds up a flower. And Mahakasyapa alone smiles. Mahakasyapa was one of his principal disciples and was one of the teachers who succeeded him, in that he had a very important role after the Buddha, while the Buddha was alive, but also after the Buddha died. In fact, it's said that when the Buddha died, and his body had been prepared for cremation, that they couldn't light it. They couldn't ignite it. It wouldn't ignite. And the reason was, they found, was because Mahakasyapa had not arrived yet. And that Mahakasyapa was some distance away and was traveling towards where the Buddha was. And he saw somebody pass by with a garland of flowers. And he said, where did you find that? because it was a ceremonial garland for a cremation. And he said, "Oh, don't you know? The world-honored one has entered nirvana." And so he hastily went to where the Buddha was, and once he arrived, then he circumambulated. The Buddha offered his gratitude and reverence, and then the pyre immediately combusted. What a great story. And so here the Buddha is, from the Zen tradition, is transmitting the Dharma, holding up the flower, Maya Kashyapa smiles. So what is happening here? Each teaching, every gesture, each step the Buddha took, before he opened his mouth, the flower was raised. What is it that Maya Kashyapa saw? Why did he smile? And as Dada Roshi asked, what if everyone had smiled? What if no one had smiled? And then he also says, bear in mind that it's not the flower, it's not the smile or the turning. That's not what this is about here. And yet, he held up a flower. How do we turn towards, how do we see ultimate truth, ultimate reality? How do we see formless form? The Buddha seriously considered after his enlightenment not teaching, because he said this Dharma is subtle and difficult to perceive directly. It can't be seen with your senses. You can't see it with your eyes. You can't hear it with your ears. You can't think it with your mind. You can't touch it with any of your senses, which is how we touch everything that we call the world. So how would he present it? How could he convey it? How could people experience it? And how could he, as the teacher, convey in his expression of the Dharma that it wasn't in him? That as his students turned to him to listen, to experience, to hear the Dharma, to not turn away from themselves. Because what he had realized was that wondrous mind of nirvana, of peace, of awakening, is present in each of us. And yet in setting up the teachings, in offering the teachings, we turn to the source of those teachings. And in that, we very easily turn away from the source of our own liberation, which is within us, in our efforts to try and acquire it from the one who has realized it. And so the Buddha was very aware that there was a great challenge. And so he said, maybe not. But then he was implored by some local deities who said, hang on, let's think this through. And he reconsidered. And he was concerned that it was futile for him to teach, because he said, as he surveyed the landscape of humanity, he said, people are too excited over their attachments. They are too enamored of their own suffering. They are too wedded to their false views. They won't want to hear this. But then after he had been appealed to, he surveyed the landscape and he realized there are those, as he said, who have little dust in their eyes, who might be able to hear. Nirvana, Thanissaro, the monk Thanissaro says, Nirvana originally comes from the word in Pali to extinguish the fire. Nibbana in Pali. And that the Buddha just took that term, which had a very ordinary usage, putting out a fire, and employed it to describe liberation. Thanissaro says, a burning fire was seen as clinging to its fuel. Right? So the fire clings to the fuel, the wood, in a state of hot agitation. and that when it finally lets go of its fuel, releases, is released from its fuel, it cools. That state of agitation is returned to a natural state of peace. And so the word nirvana means to, nirvana means to bind. Nir is a negative, so to not bind, to be unbound. Unbound by our suffering, unbound by greed, anger, and delusion. Unbound by a sense of autonomy, independent existence, separateness from all things. And so the Buddha holds up a flower. How can he convey it? And so Bodhidharma, in establishing the Zen tradition, says, in essence, it is outside of every scripture. It can't be conveyed in language. Language points to it, but it can't convey. Another way of saying it is that when you say fire, your mouth isn't burning. The word fire points to something. But what it points to is not the word. And because of our relationship with language and the self and objects, we get confused. And so here the Buddha didn't utter a word. He just raised a flower. He raised a ephemeral, fragile, fleeting piece of phenomena. What does it mean to see things as they are? Right? This is said again and again in Buddhist teachings, to see things as they are. It sounds very simple. Open your eyes and see what's in front of you. Isn't that what we're all doing? Is it? The Buddha said when we open our eyes, based in our deluded views, based in our conditioning, clouded by our own preconceptions and projections, we look at everything that is impermanent, but we see permanence. We look at things that are actually the source that brings suffering in our lives, but we see pleasure. We see possibilities of happiness. That we see things that appear to us as substantial and solid and up outside. We don't see them as empty of those very qualities. And so to see things as they are, that's why the Buddha taught that right understanding is the first of the Eightfold Path, to understand and to be, even though it begins conceptually, so to reflect on, to study the teachings of impermanence, the reality of impermanence. And Master Dogen says, you don't have to, don't make a big deal about it, just open your eyes. You don't have to employ sophisticated practices, just open your eyes, pay attention. To see what we perceive as the promise of happiness and pleasure. And the Buddha said, now, having seen that pleasure, now look a little deeper. And he said, see the danger. The danger of attaching to that, thinking that we can control that we can preserve that feeling of happiness or satisfaction or pleasure, or that we can avoid what is difficult. And so to see the eternal, to see that which is liberated from all attachments, to see that which doesn't change, that will never betray you, cannot be corrupted, cannot be acquired. He held up a flower. And as Daidaroshi says, but don't be confused. In seeing things as they are, don't think it's the flower. But the Mahakasyapa, seeing the flower, smiled. So it's not apart from the flower. And so whether it's a flower or a face or a thought or an emotion or a tree, whether it's a heaven or a hell, it's held up so that we can see it as it is. And that's why Zazen is so crucial, because it's there that moment after moment we see all the many ways in which that cloud our ability to see things as they are. We see all of the things that we think are what's in front of us. And we begin to come into direct contact. I spoke about this a little bit yesterday, that in letting go of the judging mind, it's really important to appreciate how much is in that, right? So we tend to think that when we judge, you know, that's just more thought. So don't, you know, so that's, we're trying to let go of that. Or that when we judge, you know, we tend to judge critically. And that just becomes more suffering, which is true. And so we should let go of the judgments. But what's in the judgment is the whole system. It's the whole structure. It's the sense of, I know. I already know. I know this. I know this. I know how it works. I know what I want. I know how I'm going to get it. So that judgment comes from this deeply embedded within this deep system of knowing. And what the Buddha said, that knowing is what we call delusion. That knowing is what obstructs our ability to see things as they are. And so, what's the big deal if you don't see a flower as a flower? Well, what if the flower is your child? Or the flower is your partner? Or the flower is your president? Or the flower is your death? Is that worth seeing as it is? If we have any desire to live in harmony, that means we have to live with things as they are. Everything apart from that is living in a state of conflict. To realize unboundedness, not bound to past, not bound to future, not bound to present, not bound to time and place. To let go of the fuel of our discontent. You know, it's so interesting. You know, I think when we come into practice, without knowing it, I'll speak for myself. Coming into practice without knowing it, I already knew so much about this, right? Even though if you'd asked me, I'd said, no. And I would have meant it. But already I knew so much about it because I came in with me. I came in fully loaded, fully packed, right? I'm going to do this the way I did that. I'm going to get this the way I've gotten those things. But this is going to be better. And then pretty much from the very beginning, and then constantly disrupted, disappointed. It's not going the way I planned. And that's the good news. Master Dogen said, the treasury of the true Dharma eye has never been given to others and has never been received by another. Because of this, the world honored one held up a flower and revealed the truth. Because it cannot be given, because you already possess it, the Buddha held up a flower. Not to convey it or give it or transmit it, but so that in that moment when the mind is ripe, and of course you have to understand that Maya Kashyapa had, from a Buddhist perspective, had spent many, many lifetimes arriving to this moment. But certainly he had spent all of that lifetime to arrive at this moment. just as each of us is moving through our lifetime, if we're practicing, if we're living our life toward the Dharma, to arrive at that moment where we can see. Because of this, the world honored and held up the flower and revealed the truth. Maya Kashyapa did not conceal it and smiled. So if he had not smiled, would he have been concealing it? Can it be concealed? Is there a single thing that can be hidden? You know, it's so interesting, you know, in our current state of things, to have so many examples, and some very prominent examples, of deception, in which the deception is not deceptive. Right? In other words, for a deception to be a deception, you can't see it. So what is it when you see it? What is it, a lie, when you see the lie as a lie, when it's being lied? What is it then? But what is realized, and the Buddha said, and what we realize through practice, is that awareness, the ability to see. And seeing here, we have to really understand, is not just about with the eyes. Maya Kashyapa didn't see the flower with his eyes, although his eyes saw the flower. The whole universe of Maya Kashyapa experienced the flower. Vulture Peak, in that moment, was only the flower. The lifeblood of Shakyamuni intermingled with that of Maya Kashyapa and flowed into past, present, and future. Do you see it? So we've been studying Buddha ancestors, this Ango. And I was, of course, that was very much within me as we went and traveled around India to these various places where the Buddha lived and taught. And so this reality of Buddha ancestors, this intermingling of our ancestors, our blood ancestors, our spiritual ancestors, our human ancestors, that the lifeblood of our various sort of groups of ancestors intermingle within us. We are them. They are us. We are intermingling with those who have yet to come. Do we see it? Dogen says, in this flower, there is a great basket of sutras. There is something extraordinary. This is called the world of blossoming flowers arises. I love that. In this flower is a basket of scriptures, is a whole host of teachings. Maybe all of them. Is there any teaching that is not conveyed in this flower? This world of blossoming that arises. When we set out on a path, we plan to arrive at some destination. Rightly so. When we raise bodhicitta, we establish a great aspiration to liberate self and other. When we engage in practice, in mind training, we endeavor to awaken Buddha mind. When we make commitments, that is so that we can deeply engage one thing. And those are all particular views. But it's also true that when we set out on a path, we set out just to walk. That when we raise bodhicitta, bring forth the great aspiration, there's just aspiration. There's no before and after. That when we engage in practice, there's just practice. There's no action and result. That when we make a commitment, it's just committed. Dadaroshi says, since no one has ever transmitted nor received the treasury of the true Dharma eye, why was my Kāyāshapa singled out from all of those who were present? What is the meaning of holding up the flower in Maya Kāyāshapa's smile? So from our ordinary perspective, Maya Kāyāshapa had something the others didn't have. Looking at this intellectually, we might think, well, he was more aware. The others were distracted. He was more evolved. He was superior in some way. And in that, the teaching becomes poisonous. In that, the flower becomes, rather than liberating, it becomes a kind of trap. Raising the flower, there is only this. It arises and departs in one moment. It is unbound. We can attach to the flower. The flower does not suffer under our attachment. It's just a flower. Our attachment is not in the flower. It's not in our eyes. Where is attachment? The flower and Maya Kāyāshapa in that moment knew each other. To see things as they are is to know, beyond knowing, beyond what we can express. To enter into, it often happens during as this introductory retreat that I speak with people who in various ways will speak to feeling clear about being here, even if they're still just exploring. But will often say in different ways, but I don't know why I'm here. I don't know what I'm feeling exactly. I see myself moving forward. I feel myself drawn, but I don't really understand it. And I say, bravo. Excellent. It's very helpful over time, and in a certain sense necessary, for that to become more clear. But it's also important and necessary for us to trust that without knowing. And to not be concerned if somebody asks you a question that you feel like you cannot adequately respond to. Because it's still being met. It's gaining understanding. And so, but when we are anxious about that, we cloak that. We try and put wrap that up into something that we can present to ourselves or to others. To make it into something, to name it. To describe it, to measure it, to domesticate it. We don't have to do that. And the more anxious we become, of course, the greater the efforts that are. I was thinking about, as I was preparing this talk, I was thinking about, so much of what's going on as we move towards our election, which I certainly do hope all of us will be voting on Tuesday. And all of the efforts to project, to dominate, to deceive, it's so hard, it seems, to just trust. I was thinking about that in terms of all of these reports of voter suppression, which are staggering and historical. They've been going on a long, long time. And what is that? Right? So somebody loves this country, which I would suppose means you love democracy and you love the democratic process. And out of that love, you try and destroy it. You don't actually want to know what is the voice of the people. You don't want to know that. And in fact, our founding fathers didn't completely want to know that either. Right? There wasn't a trust in a sort of collective wisdom, in the ability for us to actually make decisions, rightly or wrongly, and then take responsibility for it. Not trusting that, then some should have a voice and others shouldn't. And what kind of statement is that that's being made about this country that is being loved? What kind of love is that? And that's why, you know, in our attachments are always anxious. There's always fear in them. Otherwise, why would we? Why would we grasp so? And so the Buddha said, to face the truth, we have to have courage. We have to have courage. Be fearless. So that moment of raising the flower, in a sense, is a moment where the Buddha said, stop and look. Stop that constant cycle of turning away, not trusting. Stop. And then look. Here today there is holding up a flower. That which has been transmitted since the time of the Buddha. And as Dogen says, the flower, this flower existed before the Buddha lived, before he came to enlightenment, before he held it up. It can't be extinguished. And one of the ways you can see that is that within ourselves, that flower, that fundamental truth, is our nature. We call it Buddha nature. And that we can turn away from that. That's what delusion is. We can cover it up, try and put a lot of distance between ourselves and that basic wisdom that we know. And we can do that for a day, we can do it for decades. And it can seem like it's 100 miles away. It can seem like it's gone. But in the moment that there is one light, one ray of light within you that turns back, it's there. In full. Here and now, as Dada Roshi says. And so when you think of that in terms of practice, it means we can practice steadily, we can practice erratically, we cannot practice. We can care about our lives, we cannot care. We can care about the world, we cannot care. Those choices are up to us. But no matter how far away we've gone, no matter how far away it seems, in the single moment, before we even turn, it's there. Which means it's never lost. It's unlostable. You can't lose it. There's only the sense of loss. There's really only the sense of turning away. How can you turn away from that which is everything? And so the Buddha holds up a flower to bring that home so that we can see that. Know that. Live that. And that flower doesn't belong to Buddhism. It didn't belong to the Buddha. Buddhism, by the way, doesn't belong to Buddhism. It's not a thing. In the same way that life doesn't belong to you or me, it's not a thing. Your body and mind don't belong to you. It's not a thing. Attaining or not attaining, belonging or not belonging, it's not about acquisition. Unbound. When the fire releases from its fuel, being willing to release the cause of our suffering is the hardest thing of all. You wouldn't think so. No one thinks so in the beginning. We think, just show me where it is, and I'm letting go. We have to see it over and over. We have to see that danger. We have to experience the consequences of our own false views, our attachments. In a sense, we're all kind of thick-headed, right? Takes a while to get through. That's why it's important to be patient. Along with dismay and urgency, patience is incredibly important. You know, and we see in our world, our society, the cost of impatience. It's a terrible thing. And impatience is not waiting. It's very engaged, it's very active, but it's knowing how to work with things, how to let things that need time have time, and how to work with them while we're letting things have time. It's not passive. This flower is clear and bright. It's open and boundless. You are like this. I am like this. Then why is there so much confusion? Why is there so much unabashed greed, anger, and delusion? It's like what we see within ourselves, so we step forward, and then there's pushback. Get back in there. We step out, we release, hold back on it, grab back onto that. Right. We begin to build trust. Who the hell do you think you are? We see the same thing in our society. We step forward, we leap forward, push back. Get back in there. Go back to the way it was. Make it great again. It was never great. Not back there. This one true reality is never absent. It's never hidden. Even in our hiding, it's revealed. And so it's not about looking for something. It's about trusting that which is here now. And so let your understanding take you. Let that which you may not yet fully understand guide you. Feed it. It's like a garden that you tend. It's like a baby, as Dogen said, that you hold. You have to nurture it. You got to feed that baby. Trust your Zazen. Trust these practices. This is how the Buddha came to his enlightenment. It's not so much that we walk in his footsteps, we walk in the footsteps of practice and awakening. Those are the footsteps we walk in. As Madhata Roshi says, Mount Kutukutra is definitely present right here. The land of awakening, the homeland of the Buddha, which is the name of our trip to India, is definitely present right here. Appearing without form, responding in accord with the imperative, meeting all things as they are, in harmony, in clear understanding, bright mind. The fragrance of the flower held up fills the universe existing right here and now. The Buddha's teaching is that fragrance. The practice of the Buddha and those early disciples is that fragrance, which is being made manifest right here. The wisdom that the Buddha realized is your wisdom and my wisdom. We bring it forth. As Dada Roshi said, some will realize it and some will not. And either way is okay. And from a fundamental perspective, that's true. Not practicing doesn't diminish your self-nature. It doesn't diminish your inherent wisdom. But how we live our lives certainly does have something to do with how we live our lives. And so having come this far, whether it's a first step for you or one step within a long arc of many years of practice, to really appreciate the imperative, the importance, the wonder, the preciousness, the gift, the obligation of this life. Dogen said, mountains and rivers, sun, moon, wind, rain, as well as humans, animals, grass and trees, all of this is held up. All of this possesses the sacredness. The coming and going of birth and death is a variety, is nothing more than a variety of blossoms and colors. This world is nothing other than a dynamic display of the fundamental reality, which is by its very nature free and unfettered. It's your nature, it's my nature. Dogen says, all of this is for us to study. And in this way, each of us holds up the flower. Each of us is this very flower. And so particularly for those of you who are here for the weekend, I just really encourage, and I said this to many of you, you know, the most important thing, I feel, is that you just keep taking steps. Know in advance that you don't know where you're going, even if you think you do. You don't have to know. Just take the next step, which feels true, that is true. But it does have to be tended. We do have to actually take a step. Otherwise, life just goes by according to habit. That's the way it works. And to begin to turn that or interrupt that cycle, it takes some energy, right? Because the habit has its own momentum. That's the easy path, is to do what we've done before. And so if we've never sat meditation and you're trying to establish a meditation practice, that may be difficult, right? Because the habit is, don't do that, right? Don't think about it, and that's what will happen. And so to actually start a meditation practice means you have to actually think about it. You have to apply energy and effort. And so in the beginning, it seems hard, but it gets easier and easier. Right? And those easy paths now will get harder and harder. And so I just encourage all of us, whether we've been practicing for a moment or many years, to take care of this flower, this blossom. As I said yesterday to the group, we need people who are awake in our world. We need people who care, who give a damn, right? Who give a good damn. That is, give a damn in the right direction, right? About the right things, about affirming life rather than destroying, about loving humanity rather than hating it, about being courageous rather than fearful. This is what is needed. We are that. We are that.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.